back toe was within, I would say, 8 feet. It wasn't more than 8 feet of Mr. Pessel's desk. And she stood there by her table, standing up, reading something. And so I went in on the right side. I stepped up to the right side of her and looked over her shoulder to see what she was doing and so forth. And I suppose I wanted to make conversation. I don't know how I had the courage to do it. Maybe one of the lady teachers I might have done, but with Mr. Pessel, he was known for taking some of the boys downstairs and bending them over the bench and giving them, using a board, a piece of board to give them a licking with. And I knew that. But anyway, I stepped up to on the right-hand side of this girl, and I just put my hand down on her rear end. And I didn't ever expect that she would resent that, or at least in front of Mr. Pessel, with him so close. But she came around with her hand and just slapped me beside the face, and everything was quiet in that study hall. And that cracked like a pistol. Well, I'll tell you, it didn't take me long to start from my own place, and I came back around her, and I, of course, when I walked that aisle, I was real close to Mr. Pessel, and he eyed me every step of the way to my table, and I sat down, and he never said a word about that. I think that he thought I had had punishment enough. Once in a while, Mr. Pessel says, "I know how you fellows feel, because I was young once." Mr. Pessel was, as I said, very good to the boys that he, I guess you'd call it, he respected them. And I know there was this Straw family, and I believe there was about 10 or 11 children in that family, and they lived up where Ed Irish's farm is now. But Mr. Jones owned that farm, and they ran it to shares, and of course they never could get anywhere, really, you know, with that big family to support. And then they had to give a lot of the produce that came from that farm to Earl Jones. And anyway, there were two boys, Leon and Philip, in my class. And Leon was of the idea that he wanted to hunt very badly, and it seems that he was talking to Mr. Pessel, and he said when deer hunting come up that he says, "I'd love to go deer hunting, but we don't have any rifles at our place." And Mr. Pessel says, well, he said, "I was going out with my rifle tomorrow, but probably it wouldn't do me any good if I did, and I have some other things to do, so if you want my rifle, you can take it, and I have shells, and you won't have to buy shells." And so he said he loaned that rifle to Leon Straw each year to go hunting with. And I remember him saying one time, I was supposed to do a solo part for a graduation, sing a solo part in the song that we were doing. And I was a little quite nervous about it, and I didn't think that I could do a suitable job. And I told him that I just didn't want to do it. And he said, "Bob Gove," he said, "you have a gift from heaven in your voice." And he says, "Don't you ever be ashamed to use it, no matter where you are." And he says, "I want you to do that part. I know you can do it, and I want you to do it." And so I went ahead just the best I could.
He sounds like and quite a teacher.
Yes, he was. He
teach for a long time?
Well, he was there the 4 years that I was there, and I think he was there a year before, but then they got a different principal.
Because it was his wife that just died recently.
Yes, Mrs.
So
Pessel.
Did he live in Waitsfield all those years? Or?
He lived in Waitsfield quite a while. came from New York State or somewhere. I'm not sure where. But he had a little farm there in Waitsfield at the top of the Dugway, and he had two or three cows, and he loved to fool around and raise a garden. And she was a great hand to raise flowers. She had a beautiful flower garden. And that woman, when she was, I'm sure she must have been 85 years old, was still tending her flowers out there. You'd see her when you go by.
Now, was she a local Waitsfield?
No, she wasn't. She came from somewhere else, too. And they were married and had a family when they got there. Of course, it was years after I graduated from high school before Ray died. I think it was about, it might have been 7 or 8 years ago that he died. And he had left word with his wife that he wanted me to sing at his funeral. And I felt real good about that because I really thought a lot of the man. He did a lot for the kids that would try. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have a little story about Tom Egan and Biddy. His wife's name, at least they called her Biddy, and they lived on the back side of the square there in Warren, where Lester Senor lives now. And it seems that they had arguments once in a while, and they would stand right up to each other and just box each other's ears, barehanded, you know. And she was a large woman, larger than he was, and sometimes I hear that she even got the best of him. And they had this fight one night, and he left and went to the barn to do his chores. And I guess she was pretty well out of breath, and she went to bed. Excuse me. She didn't, and went to sleep. And Tom went to the barn and did his chores. And on the way back to the house, he had a heart attack and died there in the snow. And he was sort of hunched over, bent up a lot when he died with his knees drawn up and so forth. And she didn't know anything about it. She went to sleep, and until the next morning, and she got up. He wasn't in the house. She went to look for him. She found him dead out there in the snow. And so Oscar Eaton in Waitsfield they call it laying people out at that time. I don't think they did too much, only put them in the casket and sort of fix them up the best they could. And anyway, Oscar took this casket and went up and tried to get Tom in it. But, of course, he was bent so much that he wasn't laying down in a prone position. And so they didn't know what to do, and somebody said, well, maybe if they hung some weights on his feet and some more from his neck, that he would gradually in the house straighten out so they could shut the cover. And they had a wake at the house, and I guess there was a lot of probably not liquor, but cider, perhaps, traveling around there. And everybody was feeling their oats, and somebody suggested that they give Tom a drink. And so this man that was real intoxicated poured the glass full and started up beside the casket. And at the time, Tom's shoulders so forth were laying down there. His feet were up in the air. And when he went up to the casket, this man put his hand on Tom's feet. And, of course, that brought his head right up, right in that fellow's face. And I guess it was quite disturbing because the party broke up right away. I never did hear how, but this was a true story. Herb Blair told about this happening, and I never did hear about how that they ever got him down in that casket. Of course, I suppose if just nowadays they could use a chainsaw.
I heard that same story from Earl Long, whose mother had told him.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, just
is
about identical. Right? Yeah. And he was saying there was quite a large Irish community in Warren, I guess it was, or East Warren.
Mm-hmm. I would like to tell a little something about Frank Lamb. Do you remember if I told you about Frank Lamb and my mother racing horses on the tape?
Was he the one that always sort of kept it right ahead of your mother?
Yeah.
So that she couldn't pass?
Yeah, right. I think that I told about that, about Frank Lamb and my mother racing horses, but I don't think I told about Frank and his son-in-law, Justin Tucker, didn't get along very well. And it seems that Justin was, Frank, the father-in-law, was a great churchgoer. And he had this little bay mare that he hitched up each Sunday and went down to Warren to church. And he supported the church a lot. He had some money. And in fact, he put his grandson through college, Ransom Tucker, and he was a doctor in the town of Randolph for years and years, and they thought the world of Ransom Tucker. He was about 2 years older than I was, but he died probably 3 or 4 years ago of a heart attack. And seems that Justin and Frank were having some words about something, and I don't know what about the farm there, and Frank had gotten his little mare harnessed, and she was all ready to go, but still in the barn, and he went in the barn to get her, and he had his good suit on, and he and Justin, as I said, had words, and Justin grabbed him and threw him over in the pig pen with his good suit on. And so the story got out, the story got out after a while to people around town. And when they had town meeting, someone nominated Justin Tucker for school director. And Frank Lamb, before they could hardly get the words out of their mouth, Frank Lamb jumped upon his feet and he says, "I think that Justin is the ideal man for the spot." And they said that place, everybody just roared with laughter. That log job in Granville Woods, I'm sure that I told something about it.
No, well, that was the day we weren't recording. So you can assume that you didn't tell anything about it. It's not on tape at all.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell a few things that happened back in those years when the International Paper Company came to Granville to log off those mountains in Granville Woods. My older brother worked at the camp. All the men, they couldn't go back and forth or go to the Warren Village nights, so they had this big camp right in the fork of the road that goes down Granville Woods Way and over the hill. And it seems that my brother was there working. He was helping to load sleds. People went back, and my brother-in-law and two of my neighbors worked there in the woods with their teams, bobbing logs out, and they had these tremendous piles of logs up in the woods, and my brother went with each teamster and helped load those logs on their bobsleds for their trip down, and then they would all come down to the camp for dinner. And it seems that this Negro came along to the camp one day, and people did that quite a lot. They walked the roads and trying to get work, and he came along to that camp and wanted work, and so they hired him. And he stayed overnight. And the next morning, of course, everybody got up before daylight to go to have breakfast and go to the woods at daylight. And he went with the gang. I suppose he might have been a cutter, but I don't know. And when he came in at noon, he sat down at the table with the rest to eat. And my brother was sitting pretty close to him, and he said that the cook, they called him the cookie, they had the cook and the cookie. The cookie was the helper in the kitchen. He was a man that weighed about 300 pounds, and he walked out of the kitchen with this great butcher knife that was razor sharp in his hand. And he took that Negro by the hair of the head and bent his head back and put that knife up to his throat. And he said, "You son of a bee, you brought lice into this camp last night." And he says, "Before you eat a mouthful, I want you to go to your room and completely clean and disinfect your room. I'll give you the disinfectant." So the Negro went, of course, and cleaned his room, but he didn't stop for dinner. He took the road and went to Warren Village in hopes to find another job, I suppose.
Did they had actually separate rooms in the logging camps?
I don't think they had separate rooms. I believe they had a big room with bunks on it,
yeah,
with bunks against the wall for the men to sleep in. Well, I don't know just what it was, but his bed had, I said his room, but I don't think they had separate rooms.
Yeah. When was this, the international papers?
This was, I believe that I was about 4 or 5 years old, and now I'm 76. So, yeah.
So about 70 years ago, anyway.
70 years ago, right. I have another story to tell about a man back in those days, a true story, that worked in those lumber camps. Not that one. It was some other camp that he had worked in. And this man practiced standing 6 feet from the wall or something like that and jumping and putting his feet on the against the wall, both feet, and then coming back to the floor. See, that was the thing that he seemed to want to do. Of course, back in those days, the gang that worked in those places were pretty rough, and you had to be a sort of a fighter of some kind to stick up for yourself. Anyway, that was the way that he decided to, that he would fight, would be to put his feet, jump and put it, and he was practicing to see how high he could jump and strike that wall, and he got that down pretty good. And he, this man lived in East Warren years and years ago, and he told his next door neighbor about it, but I don't think that he told many people, and he cautioned him not to tell while he was alive. Anyway, he went to Northfield Fair, and he was enjoying the fair over there, and this man that was intoxicated kept, for some reason, kept tagging him around and saying nasty things to him and bothering him. And Alfie told him to get away and leave him alone 2-3 times, and the man didn't do it. And he jumped and struck him in the chest with his feet, and that guy dropped to the ground immediately, and they had and the people all crowded around there to see what the man, what had happened, and the man died. He broke his chest in enough so that the man died right there. And he left the crowd and came through the woods back to Warren, and nothing ever was found out about it. So back, if you lived back in those days, you lived in a kind of a treacherous world.
Well, now there were a lot of logging camps, weren't there? I mean, that was a major industry.
Yeah, logging was the big thing, and that's where all of our beautiful forests have gone. And I can't understand why that it says on a sign this side of Granville Woods that there are so many hundreds of acres of forest to be preserved forever. I believe that's on the sign, and I don't know if they've taken it down or not, but they have come in from the back, from the Granville side, way around in back. You go up by the bowl mill, up that road, mm-hmm. and it government built a roadway around there that's about four miles.
By Patterson Brook.
Right, up Patterson Brook, and they built that roadway around there, and just in the last 3 years, they have logged that mountain and just ruined it for...
What's that mountain called? Do you remember?
I don't know that it... Deer Hollow is back in there, but it's farther back. But the place that I hunted, you can go a different way up there. You can go at the height of the land where Mad River starts and where White River starts. The height of the land there, just before you go into Granville Woods. And you go right up in there, and I don't know what they call that, but a couple of years ago, they have logged around there in those. Well, I love maple trees. I love sugaring and all that goes with it, and I just about breaks my heart to see all those beautiful maples cut.
Well, you know, I was up in there, and way up, there was an old farm, and there are some old gravestones, 1827, something like that, way up.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, up Rob Ford, near Rob Ford lived.
Rob Ford, that was another you were going to tell about Elwin Shirley and Rob Ford. So that's where he lived.
Rob Ford lived up there on that... Yes.
On that farm.
Not up Patterson Brook. You go by Patterson Brook a little ways and then turn to the right, and that was Rob Ford's farm up there.
And up beyond it were these gravestones.
They had their... Sometimes way back there, families had started their graveyards, buried their dead right near their home.
And there was an old, you could see it was off an old road because the old trees lined it. Now, did his family come from there? I mean, had they been there for a long time?
Rob Ford? I don't know about his family. I really don't. I know that he was born and brought up there because Tim Goodyear went to... out there in Boyle Sap, he said 2 years for Rob Ford in sugaring, about the time that he graduated from high school. And he said that Rob told him that when company, they hardly ever had any company, but when they ever did, Rob was a small man. Rob Ford was a real small man, so he probably was a small boy for his age. And they had one of those tall living room stoves in the upper... And in the summertime, he would open up the door and get in that stove and stand there out of sight and listen to the conversation of the...
I'll be darned.
And...
Now, was that area called anything where he lived? A lot of moose up in there now.
Oh, I wish I knew more about it, but they did say that there was a man... that was calling on Rob Ford's wife while Rob was doing chores, and Rob told him that he didn't want to see him up there anymore. And Rob took his rifle to the barn with him. Now, this is a story that people told that lived there at that time, so I assume that it probably is right. And Rob had his rifle in the barn, and he was milking, and he saw that guy coming up to his farm, and he took a shot, and that was the end of it. The man was killed. Nothing was ever... You see, that was probably 1900, in the first of the 1900s, that happened. So there's two instances that we know of that people were murdered right around us here, and... Nothing was done.
The Rob Ford one, you didn't tell that on tape before. That was that day.
I should add probably that this fighting and whatnot in those days, and getting even with the people was a thing that was done. In other words, you took care of your own. You took care of your own troubles. The law wasn't called in much, and that's the way people were tough, and that's the way they lived. That was their code.
Same with doctors. You know, you didn't have a doctor you didn't go to the doctor, you didn't go to the hospital.
The Corlisses were farmers in Warren, Walter Corliss and his son Warner. And they were different for sure. They lived for their horses and their animals and their farm, and they didn't give a cent about how anybody else felt. And I know Lauren Fuller was called up there one morning to treat a sick cow. And he got up there, just before he got to Warner's house, he passed this young lady walking along. And he didn't pay any attention, and she came in the house at the same time that Lauren was in there. And Warner said to her, "What in hell are you here for this morning?" And she said, "Well, Warner, I came over to see you this morning." "Well," he says, "by God, I don't want to see you." He says, "Anybody that'll sleep with Parsons, I don't want anything to do with." And he kicked her out the door, and she went back over to Parsons, which was where she was working.
But I also heard the one about the dance. You took a girl to the dance? Okay, but that was, again, a day I didn't have the tape. Was that lunch?
When Earl told it, this was about, they used to have some pretty hot times in Warren at the dances up there, because people used to come up from Hancock and Granville and Rochester and all over to those dances, and they drank quite a lot, and when they drank, some of these men got pretty disagreeable. And I remember Lauren Fuller telling about a little episode that happened. It was in the winter, and they were having a dance there, and he built the fire and carried in quite a lot of wood and put in back of the stove to, you know, to keep the fire going during the evening. And it seems that they had intermission and went downstairs for something to eat. And when he came back upstairs, there was this pile of big pile of wood right in the middle of the floor, in the dance floor. And so Lauren went and started taking it back, putting it back out before the dancing started again. And this fellow from Granville says to Lauren, "I put that wood out in the middle of the floor because I wanted it there." He was intoxicated, see. And Lauren says, "Well, I'm taking it back because I don't want it out there." And that fellow said to Lauren, "How would you like your piano tuned?" And Lauren said, "Well, it hasn't been tuned for quite a while, probably to be a good thing." And they started in boxing each other. And finally, Lauren, he was a pretty strong man. He had shod horses and things like that. He was pretty strong. And, of course, probably this fellow was intoxicated to the extent that he wasn't himself. And Lauren finally got him over to the door that goes down the stairs. And I believe there was about a dozen stairs down to the first landing. And Lauren got behind him and pushed him. And the guy went down all those stairs to that and landed down there on what they call the landing. And Lauren jumped top of him. And he grabbed him and pulled him up on his feet, and he pushed him again, and he went down all the other stairs, headed the other way down to the bottom, and he jumped on him again down there. And when he got him on his feet, he says, "I want you to go home." And the guy went. And another little thing that happened up there at Warner Corliss took the Miller girl, the youngest Miller girl, Blanche, to the dance one night. And Blanche was a kind of a character, too, along with Warner. And they were dancing around the floor and dancing around the floor, and I guess she must have been shaking her hips pretty good because her pants dropped down around her ankles on the dance floor. And of course, everybody saw it and were laughing. And instead of kicking them off, she stood there and was pulling them back up. Anyway, what's the man's name? Larney Little married Blanche after a while. And Larney was a character, too. He came from Roxbury to work for my brother-in-law in the sugar place. And he was a poor boy from a poor family, and he didn't talk too wonderful. And he said, by gosh, he says, when I get all this money, he says, I'm going to have a new suit and a new pair of shoes and a felt hat. And he says, they won't even know me when I go back where I came from, will they? But I guess he never got money enough to do all that. He's...
Now, is he still alive, or...?
No, Larney and Blanche are both dead now. I guess they were about my age, probably, or maybe a little bit older. We had a doctor in Mad River Valley, and his name was Dr. Shaw. And he never went to medical school in his life, they tell me. He read books, and that was back when you could study that way at home, and if you proved yourself, you could become a doctor. And he was in Roxbury for a long time, and he had a large family. And